Hello and welcome to this week's dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM up there in Preston, Radio Verulam in St Albans, and also our listeners in Swindon, coming up on this week's show.
We lived there all over the history, and now we're ready to die in our lands. And more than 60 years without our lands, you know, 63 years, and all the time we wait for the justice.
Yes, later on in the show, you can hear Dr. Awad Abu Free from Al Arabiq talking about the plight of the Bedouins in the Middle East. As the world media focuses on events in Syria and Egypt at the moment, the problems being faced in Palestine here are being pushed into the background somewhat. So to correct that, we have in the studio this week Emma and Nathan, who have recently returned from a visit to the West Bank. And on a possibly more cheerful note...
Yes, David Owen is also here in the studio to talk about the Palestinian Film Festival starting this weekend in Bristol. So we've got civil rights, human rights, and we've also got animal rights coming up in the show. Yes, we've got an interview with two animal rights campaigners. And that's taking place with Animal Rights Day being commemorated on the Saturday, the 10th of December. Malcolm Grieve, of course, reads the second part of Chapter 27 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson.
And our poet of the week, as he has been quite a lot lately, Tim Burrows, because we like him so much, is here again, and he's going to play the acoustic guitar. Plus, as always, we have the What's On Guide. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis.
Our first interview is with David Owen, who's taken time out from his busy schedule to come in and talk about the first ever Palestinian Film Festival starting here in Bristol this weekend. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good.
You look like you've been very busy all day.
Yeah, we're just making the arrangements for the film festival at the moment and just sort of touching base on some finer details.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So when does it actually start?
Well, it started on the 1st of December. We had an opening night at the gallery at Hamilton House in Stokes Croft. So we've got a arts and photography exhibition going on from the 1st to the 10th of December.
Okay.
And that's kind of celebrating all sorts of different aspects of Palestinian culture as part of the film festival.
Okay, so what sort of connections with Palestine have you actually got to create what people will see?
Well, all sorts of different things. I suppose the main thing is we've tried to focus a lot on Palestinian directors and their work, and that's been really interesting, trying to bring that over to Bristol and to screen that kind of thing. And another big theme running through the festival is what local people do in Palestine. And so there's a couple of groups that all do work in Palestine. So, for example, this Thursday on the 8th of December at the Cube, we've got the Eastern Cowboys talking about their trip to Palestine.
Okay, now the Eastern Cowboys, they are a football team who are sort of there for the purposes of playing football with people in Palestine. They go on tour.
Yeah,
is that my understanding is correct?
Yeah, one of the big themes of the festival is Palestine is a place that you can visit. And Leila Sansour, she's one of our speakers, and she runs a charity which is called Open Bethlehem, which is just about keeping Palestine open for the world. And I think one of the things the festival is trying to do is to kind of counteract some of that mainstream media image that you get, and that it isn't a safe place to visit. And whilst there are challenges, there are reasons to go over there. There are reasons to make connections.
Okay. So it's not just a location that you view with sympathy from a distance.
No,
you
know,
if you actually go there.
Yeah.
Do you think if you actually went there, that would affect how Israelis treated Palestinians? Are there a lot more Western tourists there?
And I think that's what some of the groups are trying to do, is, you know, like Leila Sansour's charity, is to create an industry around tourism, which is Israel itself is reliant on tourism. And so there's no reason why places like Bethlehem, Jerusalem, shouldn't really be celebrating that aspect of what they can do.
Okay, what sort of films are we talking about? I mean, obviously, with the situation going on there, we obviously imagine there'll be lots of very serious documentaries.
Well, we've tried to avoid that. So in the programming, what we've tried to do is anything that's kind of says how many people were killed in this intifada and how many, we've actually said, well, that information is available elsewhere.
Yeah.
What we've tried to do with the films is to pick films that are, in a way, telling a different story, telling the human experience of Palestine. And so we've picked films about humour in Palestine.
Okay.
We've picked films about football in Palestine. We've picked foods about food in Palestine. And so it's really, 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 really about what it is to be a human being in Palestine. And it's about empathy with that rather than any kind of sympathy.
Okay, these films are being shown at Hamilton House?
A lot of our films, so coming up on Sunday at 3 o'clock, we've got at the Watershed two films, one from a Palestinian director called Amrika, which is a comedy, and one about an amazing film, which I think might be film of the festival, called Eid, which is about a Bedouin guy called Eid, and really recommend you go and see that.
Okay. Are you doing any more screenings of the latter particularly, or is it different films every day?
Absolutely. On Tuesday at 6 o'clock at the Watershed, we've got a film called My Name is Alam, which has won several awards, and again is quite an inspirational film.
So that's Tuesday the 6th of December, I think I'm right.
That's correct,
okay,
yes.
Brilliant.
And then we've got another film showing at Hamilton House, like you mentioned, on the 9th of December at 6:30. What I'd encourage people to do is, if they're interested, log on to bristolpff.org.uk.
Okay, and if you check that out, there'll be more details about the festival and the timings and the locations and so forth.
Yeah, and we had Ken Loach open the festival, so there'll be an audio recording of Ken's speech.
Oh, fantastic.
And all sorts of stuff, so...
How difficult was it actually to organise a Palestinian film festival? How did you sort of do the research for all this stuff? I assume you just don't log onto a Palestinian website and go, oh, these are good, so I'll download all of those.
It's all about partnership. So we partnered Sheffield Showrooms, and there's a group there called Cinema Palestino, which we work with a lot. Palestine's got quite a thriving film industry at the moment, and there's a website called Dreams of a Nation, and you can get quite a lot of information about that.
Okay, that might be quite a surprise to a lot of people.
Absolutely.
That there is a thriving industry in Palestine.
Yeah, it's struggling in terms of all of the things that Palestine struggles with around the occupation, but at the same time, that is also a hotbed for creativity, and people are putting films out there that are definitely worth watching.
Do you feel you know a lot more about Palestine now than you did when you sort of started organising this festival?
Well, that was why I got involved. I mean, I'm no expert, so my priority was to put on a film festival that anyone like myself could go to and enjoy.
Cool. What do you hope people will gain from it if they turn up?
For me, it's about just engaging with the issues, seeing the people as they are, and just not switching off the news, just getting involved, just learning. It's the first step on a kind of...
Okay. And the website, once again, if people want to find out more?
It is bristolpff.org.uk.
Thank you very much, David Owen, and
thank you.
Very best of luck.
No, good luck. Cheers.
A track now from Joan Baez, a famous protest singer from the US. This track is called Lowlands. Buyers there with Lowlands.
Well, in the studio with me now are two representatives of the International Solidarity Movement, Nathan and Emily. Just come back from Palestine. Well, I say just, how long ago were you there?
We were there for 3 weeks in October.
So you must have seen quite a wide variety of stuff going on. You were there for quite a while.
Yeah, we were based in Hebron, towards the south of the West Bank. There's an illegal settler community right in the middle of the city, so it's a focus point for a lot of tension.
So tell us a little bit about the International Solidarity Movement. How long has that been going on for?
It's been going on for about 10 years. Before we went, we did 2 days of training with International Solidarity Movement, or ISM. We did that in London.
Okay, so they're like an international organisation, I guess, are they?
Yeah, that's right. It's Palestinian-led, but there's volunteers from all over the world, including, we should stress, Israeli volunteers as well, which is important. It's pro-Palestinian, but it's not anti-Israel. It's anti the illegal settlements, is anti the Israeli policy as okay. It is at the moment.
So what attracted you to the ISM?
I like the fact that this is a non-violent organisation. It's not an ideology, so you're not subscribing to humanism or pacifism. This is non-violence as a tactic, as something you can employ on the ground in order to hopefully make things better. It's precisely because the ISM doesn't and won't use violence that makes it so effective. It's illustrated by the fact that if you go to Tel Aviv Airport, and if they suspect that you're in any way associated with this movement, then you'll be refused entry to Israel. Essentially, they're refusing entry to peace activists from a legal and expressly non-violent humanitarian group.
Okay,
we'll
come back to that in a second. Over to you, Emily. I mean, what attracted you to the ISM, and what do you hope to achieve through it?
Well, I knew about it because I had some friends who had been with ISM to Palestine. The two main reasons that I wanted to go were, one, to stand in solidarity with Palestinian people, and two, to be able to come back to the UK and to raise awareness of the issues that Palestinian people are facing, which is what I'm hoping to do through things like this.
Okay, Nathan, did you sort of get the feeling that Palestinians feel sort of quite isolated? How much do they know about what people outside Palestine really know about what's going on?
On the ground, by being there, we're able to, in a small way, help people to feel less isolated. Of course, Palestine is isolated, and we see this in the international community, and we're seeing this with the UN at the moment. It's our role in order to stop them feeling isolated, which we can do by doing the kind of work we're doing with the ISM, which we can also do, of course, by lobbying our MPs in a number of ways. We chose to go over there this time. Not making huge sweeping differences whilst you're over there, but what you are able to do is have those one-to-one human interactions.
And they must have loved you being there then, in a way.
Yeah, we felt ridiculously welcomed everywhere we went. People were really so hospitable and generous.
I think we felt that before they found out we were doing
Well, they must have sort of spotted that you were, foreigners to an extent, obviously straight away, I would have imagined.
Yeah, I think it is. There's not that many people travel to the West Bank, and they're just really grateful to have anyone going there so that they can share their stories. And
what is it actually like there? Is it sort of a heavily urbanised sort of area, or is it sort of scattered towns and sort of scrub? I mean, what is there in Palestine?
Well, parts are. I mean, the West Bank is divided in three zones. So when we think of the West Bank and we think, well, this is the Palestinian area, perhaps, that Israel's building a wall around it. So you think, oh, well, that's Palestine on that side. But it's still divided by Israel into these three main zones. So there's Zone A, which is a few cities, including the city of Hebron. But Zone A are these Palestinian areas controlled by the Palestinian Authority and have Palestinian police there. A much larger area is Zone B, which has Palestinian control for civil affairs, but then still a military presence. And then there's Zone C, so this is within the West Bank still, but this is under complete Israeli military control. And actually these areas, Zone B and Zone C, make up for the far majority of the West Bank. Maybe, is it 60% or something?
On which subject, how on earth did you get in?
We were told in the training that we had with ISM, the main thing is just not to say at all that you're going anywhere in the West Bank, sort of pretend that you don't know what Palestine is.
Okay.
Which is fascinating in itself, isn't it? But we're there with a legal, pro-peace, expressly peaceful organisation, and it's perfectly legal. If at Tel Aviv they believe you're part of this organisation, and not just the ISM, but the Christian Peace Corps, they'll turn you around and not let you in. So it's both completely baffling and unbelievable that they would turn you away, but I think it's also quite positive.
That you would actually have to be blocked, even though you're perfectly peaceful.
That you would have to be blocked.
If you are a Palestinian, I mean, what sort of state institutions do they have? What, have you committed a crime? Are there Do the Palestinians have their own legal system? Or?
Well, there's certainly, as I say, within these various zones which have a Palestinian police force. But with regard to the legal situation, that raises really interesting questions itself, because in the West Bank, what we have is effectively a tiered legal system. Well, it's a three-tiered legal system. Israeli people are subject to civil law, and they enjoy the same kind of privileges that perhaps we have over here. Yeah, exactly. Internationals have a subject to international law, so again, we're pretty well treated, to be honest. Palestinian people in Zone B and Zone C, so for the most of the West Bank, they're subject to military law, where they have virtually no rights whatsoever. They can be detained under what's called administrative detention, where you can be detained for up to 6 months at a time without being told why, without your lawyer being told why. So we can talk about it like this academically, but the people we met there, everyone you meet has either themselves or a member of their family has been subject to this. One of the things we did was go to protest marches about this, about the treatment of Palestinian people under this law.
So moving on to a more practical level then, on the ground, therefore, away from Syria, what is it like? Because I understand you attended a demolition of a Palestinian's property. I mean, and only what happened?
We got a phone call early one morning saying that a house was due to be demolished in a village near Hebron. Unfortunately, by the time we got there, the house had already been demolished by the Israeli army. We later that day met the guy whose house it was, who was a lovely guy, and actually on our blog there's a video. We interviewed him and he talks about how he feels about the house demolition. But he was building the house at the time for him, his wife and their 10 children. So obviously he was just devastated. And
Where did he go?
He was living in a rented house whilst he was building this house.
Okay.
It was amazing. In the video that we have of him, I think we've got a quote of what he said. We asked him what he was going to do next, and he said, "I'll build it again, and if they take it down, I'll do it again and again. If I die, my son will do it. If my son dies, his son will do it. Until we all die, that's what I'm planning to do, to stay here, plant the land, build houses and die here, because we have no other place to live."
What did you bring that was really positive from the experience? And obviously you've seen a lot of the obviously terrible things that are going on, but what did you bring from it? You thought, actually, that's, you know, that's a really positive thing that I saw.
Even
if it was just something that was just like, you know, actually, that was a lot of fun, irrespective.
Certainly with the people we met, we were working with, I mean, these are an oppressed people, and they're facing the kind of, you know, nightmare difficulties that we don't have to. There was no malice or hatred, there was no feeling of kind of wanting revenge. I mean, these were a really, again, the people we met, and that's all we can speak about, but a dignified and hopeful people looking for fairness. And I guess, you know, that's very inspiring to be around people like that.
Yeah. Did you feel in danger? Was it quite a scary experience?
Part of our work, we would go along to protests and direct action movements. So I was talking about the demonstrations around the prison, the situation, the legal situation and the situation for prisoners. So we went to a number of marches around that were specifically demonstrating around, I can find here, there were marches that were supporting 9 demands of Palestinian prisoners, which include the right to family visits, end of the use of isolation as a punishment, and the profiteering of Israeli prisons from financial penalties charged against Israeli prisoners. We'd go on these marches and there would be disproportionate tactics used by the Israeli military in order to break these up. And at those times, yes, it was frightening, because
it's frightening when there's the extent of the Palestinian weaponry would be teenagers throwing stones. The response from the Israeli army to that every time that we went to a protest would be sort of firing tear gas canisters, sometimes straight at the teenagers, sound grenades,
yeah.
And it was just such a disproportionate response. And I think that was the only time that I felt.
And that's frightening, because you're there and they're coming at you as well, of course. But by being there, because we're there as internationals, they fire tear gas, whereas if international people weren't there, they might use live ammunition.
So there's
absolutely a benefit,
yeah.
And to view what's going on and to, you know, film what's going on and
so
report.
So it's interesting that the Israelis are publicity conscious. If there are internationals there, they will behave differently.
Absolutely, yeah, because they've got this veneer of respectability. So
and briefly, lastly, I guess, I mean, how do you actually sort of physically get in and out of the West the West Bank? I mean, once you've sort of, you know, landed in Tel Aviv and they think you're just there for a holiday, I mean, how do you actually get in there?
Surprisingly easy, actually. There's buses straight to Ramallah.
Just you get on a bus?
Jerusalem, yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, if you look at Israel and the Palestinian territories, the Lonely Planet, it says you must visit Hebron. Hebron's the hidden jewel. You know, these are places that are recommended that tourists can go to. And yet, if the authorities suspect that you're going there and doing this kind of work there, they'll tell you that, oh no, you can't go there. It's illegal. Some of the...
You read between the lines.
Activists were asked at the airport to sign documents to say they wouldn't go to the West Bank in order to be allowed in.
Okay, where can people find out more about the International Solidarity Movement?
It was great. They've got a website, which I think is palsolidarity.org.
Well, Nathan and Emily, thank you very much for coming in, and hopefully we'll hear more about Palestine.
Can we just plug our blog? We were keeping a blog whilst we were out there, and the address for that is gettingoffthearmchair.wordpress.com.
Oh, I'd like to introduce to the studio Karen and Caroline. Hello.
Hiya.
Hi.
You have very similar sounding names and very similar sounding voices.
Quite confusing.
I shall have to delineate you a little. Karen, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm an academic. I'm a sociologist, and at the moment I'm working at Bristol University.
Okay. And Caroline?
I'm a local activist involved in Bristol Animal Rights Collective.
Okay. And you both met each other through the Animal Rights Collective, I assume?
Yes, we did. Yeah.
So how long has the Bristol Animal Rights Collective been going on?
Oh, probably about 7 or 8 years now, but various people have been involved in it. So I think I've been around for about 2 or 3 years, and there's still some people that have been around for about 7 years.
Right.
And it's had various names before that, so I think there has been animal rights groups in Bristol for quite a long time. Probably about 20 years.
Whenever people come who are members of groups, I often ask them, you know, what does Bristol Animal Rights Collective enable you to do that other organisations you feel have obviously failed to do?
I suppose we're very much grassroots, aren't we? So we do quite a lot of stalls in the streets. We get a chance to speak to local people. So we've got quite a lot of local knowledge, which is really helpful. We also don't receive funding from the government or anyone who's actually controlling what we're doing. So we've got complete autonomy from that, and we can campaign in a way that we think is most appropriate for the animals.
Okay, and do you find this is going down well? Have you got more and more converts? Are you a growing
group? Yeah, definitely a growing group. It seems to be getting bigger and bigger all the time. We certainly noticed with our demos and meetings that we're probably about double in size to how we were, you know, a few years ago. It's great.
What sort of angle do you take in it? Some groups are quite moralistic about it, and others are just sort of more about the health aspects and vegetarianism. A very healthy lifestyle. I mean, do you have any particular angle on that?
I think we tend to go to the animal rights side of it. So we're very much trying to target, if we're encouraging people, for example, to be vegan, we do promote the animal rights argument. I think people are more likely to stay vegan if they become vegan for animal rights issues rather than health issues.
So, yeah, we're more likely to talk about the ethics rather than nutrition.
Do you see sort of vegetarianism as opposed to veganism as sort of slightly less righteous than veganism, or is it sort of just as bad if you're using dairy products? What sort of a viewpoint do you take? Are you quite sort of hard line about your views, as some people may see it?
Personally, we're both vegan, and we think veganism is the correct way to go in terms of animal rights, but we were both vegetarian before we became vegan, so we appreciate that people go through a process, that sometimes it takes time for people to want to make that change to veganism or to understand the implications of veganism. So we went through that process ourselves, and we appreciate that other people want to take time to think about the issues and understand the issues.
Okay. I mean, do you perceive, in times get a bit philosophical, I guess, seeing as we're discussing animal rights, are animals equal to humans in status?
I think animals and humans, we have different rights. We're equal in terms of we have a right to life, we're sentient beings. If you're talking about equality in terms of law, then obviously there are different implications. But in terms of being sentient, thinking beings, we're all the same, and we don't see humans as having any more right to life than any other animals.
I mean, just
it's just like, just like adults have different rights to children. Yeah. So we're able to vote, whereas children aren't able to vote, but children are as important as adults. And we also think that animals and people are important. So we don't think animals are more important than people, but we think animals and people are important.
Okay. I mean, I'll give you an example that leads up to my question to explain what I'm going to say. But I mean, during at the height of the Iraq War, fox hunting was a very important issue. And more than 700 parliamentary hours were spent discussing the rights of foxes when a lot of people were getting killed overseas. Shouldn't there really be priorities here of human life over animal life?
I would certainly say that animals and people are important. So, you know, animals are as important as people. I wouldn't say that animals are more important or people are more important. So I think that you can't really prioritise like that. It's just like you can't say that older people are more important than children. Quite often there's the sort of issues being discussed at the same time.
Okay. Animals are a subject of a lot of sentimentality in English and British culture, I've noticed. And do you think animal rights are taken off in Britain more so than on the continent because of that?
No. Possibly.
I don't think so. No.
Okay, disagreement there. Why do you not think so?
I think that we're sentimental about animals, but I think it is just sentimentality rather than any real understanding of ethics.
Okay, so the understanding of animal rights is not necessarily related to sentimentality?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. What if you discovered some roadkill or an animal that died naturally? I mean, there's nothing, you haven't killed anything. You could cook that for tea.
No.
No, I mean, I would feel quite revolted, I suppose, eating roadkill in the same way that I'd feel quite revolted eating a dead person. It would have that kind of feeling to me. And I think it would be quite disgusting, but I wouldn't be ethically against it. So I think there's nothing wrong with someone else. You know, if someone said that they'd eaten roadkill, I'd think that's fine. Actually, it's reducing waste, but I personally would feel quite
if somebody didn't feel revolted by that idea, they're not revolted by eating meat. Was that feeling of revulsion in you something that evolved, or was it just something that came upon you one day? People might be thinking, well, I'm not revolted, so vegetarianism or veganism doesn't sound like something that's going to be for me.
I think for me it's something that evolved. When I stopped eating meat, it wasn't because I didn't like the taste of meat. I liked it when I stopped, but I stopped eating meat because I decided, or I kind of came to realise that animals have feelings as well, and so animals are sentient beings.
So you were sort of inured to the morality of it through just habit?
Yes.
And nothing. Yeah. Okay, I suppose we should really move on to what is coming up in the near future, in early December. You have, well, there is the International Animal Rights Day generally, and the Bristol Animal Rights Collective are celebrating that. What are you doing?
We're organising a cruelty-free festive fair, which is taking place on Saturday the 10th of December at Broadmead Baptist Church. It's from 11 to 5 and it's free entry.
Okay, the Broadmead Baptist Church, I'll actually walk past this all the time. A lot of people will just forget that phrase and forget about it. But if you know where the Odeon Cinema is, right in the middle of town, there's that street there, and you've got, I think, Next or Northern Face or something, a shop. And on the other side, there's just a sort of, you might walk past it and not even see it. It's in there. There's a door that leads up to there. So what can people expect when they go there?
Well, first of all, they'll see a person in a cow outfit dancing outside to highlight where the venue is. And once they're inside, it's free entry and there's lots of stalls. There's campaign stalls. Do you want to go through the stalls?
Campaign stalls. There's going to be animal rights organisations and animal sanctuaries, but there's also going to be some human rights organisations as well, including the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who are going to be coming along and giving out some free Palestinian food samples.
What about, just to interrupt a little, because we're coming to the end, I mean, what about people who might be worried that this sounds like this is going to be letting themselves in for an awful lot of moralising?
Oh, there'll be fun things as well.
There'll be plenty of fun things to do. And some vegan food?
Yeah, there'll be loads of nice food.
And children's entertainment.
And children's entertainment as well.
Yep.
Okay, so Saturday the 10th of December, 11 a.m. till 5 p.m. at the Broadmead Baptist Church. And there's a full programme online at bristolanimalrights.org.uk, where no doubt you can obviously read lots more detail about what we've been discussing. So, Karen and Caroline, thank you very much.
Is it right to say one more thing very quickly? The first 50 people that come along and say cow's milk is for calves, that's the phrase. So the first 50 people that say that will get a free gift.
Get a free gift. Brilliant.
We're now going to hear an interview about the plight of the Bedouins in the Negev area of Israel. Dr. Awad Abu Frey, 49 years old, is head of the chemistry department of Sapir College in the Negev. He's also a spokesman for the Bedouin people of the village of Al-Araqib. Al-Araqib has featured in the news regularly, having suffered the cruel fate of being bulldozed and rebuilt no less than 28 times since July 2010, an action which has severely affected the livelihoods of 300 people in the village. Israelis are using the Bedouin lands to enable the establishment of Jewish settlements, agricultural projects and forests. Dr. Abu Frey currently coordinates a new umbrella group, Recognition Now, which brings together Bedouin, Jewish and international groups who are campaigning for the return of the Bedouin lands. In this interview with Anthea Page, Dr. Abu Frey talks about the problems his people are facing as they witness the loss of their civil rights and ancient lands in the Negev.
My name is Dr. Awad Abu Frey.
You're from Palestine?
Yes, I'm from Palestine. I'm a Palestinian, from the Palestinian who live in Israel now.
And you've come over to Britain to tell people about the plight of the villages?
Yes, we feel all the time that the world hear about the Palestinian who live in Gaza or the Palestinian who live in West Bank or in Jerusalem. But our story, nobody know. We are living in our land, in our villages. We still stay in the land which occupied in 1948, not 1967. We still there in our lands. We were there thousands of years. And we became Israeli because we have the passport. I'm a citizen of Israel, but I'm a Palestinian. We are a Bedouin living in the Negev. And now we're suffering all the time because the Israelians destroy our homes. Our villages, we live in unrecognized village and we live without conditions, without water, without electricity, anything. But we live in our land and we are a farmer. Now they take our land. We can't use our land. We can't live like Israeli citizen. One thing we can do to leave, the Israelians want us to leave the Negev, the Nakab in Arabic, to leave the Nakab to maybe to Jordan or to Egypt. But we were there all the time over the history. This is our land, and we have the documents that we have a permit from British, when the mandate from Turkey, the Ottoman period, the Ottoman time, we were there, and they give us the recognition, and the British give us also the recognition. But the Israelian, they thought when they came, the Zionism project in Palestine, when they came to the Negev, they hope that they will be empty of people, empty of Arabs, empty of Palestinians. But maybe for them, it's a sudden shock because this is our land and we stay there. Now, before 1948, we were there more than 100,000 people who live in the Negev. The Negev is a very big area and we live in all the area of the Negev. 1948, 90% of the Bedouin who live in the Negev exiled, killed, or pushed to move to Jordan. Only 10,000 people stay in the land. The army of the Israelian relocated us all the Negev and pushed us in some very small zone. We called it Siyaj zone or restricted zone. And nobody can go out from this restricted zone.
You're like prisoners in your own land.
Yeah, we call us now the refugees in our land. We are refugees, but in our land. Now, like camps, but in our land. We saw our land, but we can't use it. Some of us now slide out from this block area, like me and like my family and like my village, and we built again our village, Kol El Arakib. When we built it in 1958, 1960, we built some of them, not all the village, because in 1948, there's 100 of people killed there. Only in our village, 13 people were killed by the kibbutz and the mushav, you know, the Israelian who live near our neighbors, the Israelian. But we built some of our village and we still there. It was very difficult. But all the time Israelian demolished the village, we built it again. They move us to that area and we slide and we run away from this blocked or jail, very big jail. That's like a jail, like Gaza. All the world now speak about Gaza. In the Negev, we like Gaza. There is no separated wall, but there is a law, army laws, army rules, in spite of the fact that we are citizens, but we are under colonial rules. Under now, we are struggle all the time for education, struggle for schools, for water, basic, very basic rights. Very basic right of water, right of housing, right of roads. We built roads, they destroy it. We built bridges and in the valleys we can't move from place to place, they destroy it. We built homes, they destroy it. The land only the Jews can use the land as a farmer. Now we have only some water to drink, but all the Jews near us, they can use a lot of water in their land. But we have to buy the water from them. For example, we pay for 1 cube of water more than 50 shekels, and it costs in the kibbutz, in our neighbors, 2 shekels or 3 shekels. We pay 50 shekels for 1 cube of water. We have to transfer the water from place to place. There is no running water in our village. Nothing. And now there is a new, very dangerous plan. The government call it power report. By the law, by the Israelian law, we are invaders, that we invade the land of the state. And the Jews said we have to save. You know, I'm sorry to say that. I have nothing against the Jews in the world. I'm working with the Jews. But now there is the law. They said that we have to save the land from the others. Who's the others? We are the others. To save it, to take it back from the Bedouin, to relocate the Bedouin again in very small area. And they called it like this. There is a road number 40. It's crossed the Negev from the north to the south to divide the Negev two part. The eastern one, Bedouin can live. In the western side, no Bedouin. Only for Jews, because the western side, there's good rain and there's green. And now they push us to the desert, to the dry, very dry space that we have nothing to do there, just to live and, you know, to suffer. And maybe they hope, maybe they will leave to another place. But I think it's very, very difficult now to explain to the world and also to the Israelian, we are ready to die there. We are ready. We live there all over the history. And now we're ready to die in our lands. And more than 60 years without our lands, you know, 63 years. And all the time we wait for the justice. Maybe every year we hope that we will have justice and we maybe return to our lands. But now we know there's no justice in Israel. Israel is racism. We feel the discrimination. We feel the apartheid, a new apartheid now in the Negev. We feel the rules of army, colonial rules against us. And now we tell everybody in the world, till now we are unviolent people. Our struggle all the time, we say everybody in the world, also in our sons, in our new generation, we are no violent. We are civilians. But I think that the new generation, it will be different. I think the new generation now very, very angry.
Can you tell listeners one really shocking point, and that is that the Israeli government have wiped your villages off the map? You're not registered, are you?
I think it's very usual for me. I'm not surprised, because the Israelian want to clean the map from the name of the Arabs, not only in the Negev and all of Israel. There is a law, new law, have to write in the map only Jewish names.
They want to wipe you off the face of the earth.
Yeah, this is what I think that the plan of Sharon, and the Sharon, you know, Eric Sharon, who's a big commander and the prime minister of Israel, to Judaize the Negev and Judaize the names and the man and the human, everything. And now there's one enter the war against us, the JNF, the Jewish National Fund, work together with the old authorities. Now the JNF take our land. They took our land. They said, like, they lease the land from the Israeli land authority. This is our land with very big forest. They changed the names. They changed the valleys. They changed the hills. Now I can't understand. I can't recognize my land because the land now changed. Everything changed. And now only some of the villages, Bedouin village, you can see in the map. My village, Al-Araqib, you can't find it in the Israeli map. We know that this is a war against the collective memorial. They want us to forget everything, to forget our source, where we come from, our names, our valleys. But I think it will not happen.
The Israeli government are stealing your land, so they're criminals.
This is against human rights, clearly. Israeli, I think it's know that. We were in the UN. We send a lot of letters to the UN Committee of Human Rights and to the ambassadors in the world. Israel said all the time, the law is the Israeli law. This is our land, and all the lies that Israeli now tell the world. This is a criminal war. There is a war from the state against its own citizens. This is a war against us, and we are Israeli citizens. I don't choose to be Israeli because we were there all the time. But when Israel established in 1948, we stay there. The Israelis push us out. We stay only 10% still in the lands. And now the Israelis take our land and make all the problems. And they know this is against the human rights in the world. They know, but they never mind.
What's happening about the human rights and the UN?
Maybe they do something, but not enough. They protest, but not enough. Unless the European and America stop the supporting blind. I think this is the problem of us, that the Israelis know all the time we are in the East, but all the West is with us, and America is also with us. And the simple people in America, simple people in Britain here, and the simple people maybe in all Europe, know nothing, I think. Only they hear the one side, the story of the Israeli. But what about our side? We are human. I'm a man, and I want to live in my land, and I have a lot of children, and I have a dream, and I want my people also have a dream like all the others. We want to live in dignity like all the others in the world. All the others in the world, all the world now have to know, in Israel, if you are not Jews, you can't live. If you are not Jews, you can't have a water.
But what about the Jewish people? Don't they feel some kind of guilt about what they're doing to you?
In Israel, there is some of Jewish people who work with us against the policy of their government. And in the world also, I feel that the Jewish people have feel something to correct the government of Israel. But I think it's not enough. The Israelian now make a lot of mistake, you know, after Gaza war and after all that happened now in the West Bank and against Lebanon and now against their citizens. If they continue in their policy, it's dangerous for them and it's dangerous for all the others and also dangerous for all the world.
That was Anthea Page talking to Dr. Awad Abu Frey about the loss of ancient Bedouin lands and civil rights in the Negev area of Israel.
Onwards to another instalment of Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island, read by Malcolm Grieve. This is Chapter 27, Part 2.
I had nothing nearer my fancy than to get home to the stockade and boast of my achievements. Possibly, I might be blamed a bit for my truantry. But the recapture of the Hispaniola was a clenching answer, and I hoped that even Captain Smollett would confess I had not lost my time. So thinking, and in famous spirits, I began to set my face homeward for the blockhouse and my companions. I remembered that the most easterly of the rivers which drain into Captain Kidd's anchorage ran from the two-peaked hill upon my left, and I bent my course in that direction that I might pass the stream while it was small. The wood was pretty open, and keeping along the lower spurs, I had soon turned the corner of that hill and not long after waded to the mid-calf across the watercourse. This brought me near to where I had encountered Ben Gunn, the Maroon, and I walked more circumspectly, keeping an eye on every side. The dusk had come nigh hand completely, and as I opened out the cleft between the two peaks, I became aware of a wavering glow against the sky, whereas I judged the man of the island was cooking his supper before a roaring fire. And yet, I wondered in my heart that he should show himself so careless. For if I could see this radiance, might it not reach the eyes of Silver himself, where he camped upon the shore among the marshes? Gradually the night fell blacker, and it was all I could do to guide myself even roughly toward my destination, The double hill behind me and the spyglass on my right hand loomed fainter and fainter. The stars were few and pale, and in the low ground where I wandered, I kept tripping among bushes and rolling into sandy pits. Suddenly a kind of brightness fell about me. I looked up. A pale glimmer of moonbeams had alighted on the summit of the spyglass, and soon after I saw something broad and silvery moving low down behind the trees. I knew the moon had risen. With this to help me, I passed rapidly over what remained to me of my journey, and, sometimes walking, sometimes running, impatiently drew near to the stockade. Yet, as I began to tread the grove that lies before it, I was not so thoughtless, but that I slacked my pace and went a trifle warily. It would have been a poor end of my adventures to get shot down by my own party in mistake. The moon was climbing higher and higher. Its light began to fall here and there in masses through the more open districts of the wood, and right in front of me, a glow of a different colour appeared among the trees. It was red and hot, and now and again it was a little darkened, as it were the embers of a bonfire smouldering. For the life of me, I could not think what it might be. At last I came right down upon the borders of the clearing. The western end was already steeped in moonshine. The rest, and the blockhouse itself, still lay in a black shadow, checkered with long, silvery streaks of light. On the other side of the house, an immense fire had burned itself into clear embers and shed a steady red reverberation, contrasted strongly with the mellow paleness of the moon. There was not a soul stirring, nor a sound beside the noises of the breeze. I stopped, with much wonder in my heart, and perhaps a little terror also. It had not been our way to build great fires. We were, indeed, by the captain's orders, somewhat niggardly of firewood, and I began to fear that something had gone wrong while I was absent. I stole round by the eastern end, keeping close in shadow, and at a convenient place where the darkness was thickest, crossed the palisade. To make assurance surer, I got upon my hands and knees and crawled without a sound towards the corner of the house. As I drew nearer, my heart was suddenly and greatly lightened. It is not a pleasant noise in itself, and I have often complained of it at other times, but just then it was like music to hear my friends snoring together so loud and peaceful in their sleep. The sea cry of the watch, that beautiful "All's well," never fell more reassuringly on my ear. In the meantime, there was no doubt of one thing. They had kept an infamous bad watch. If it had been Silver and his lads that were now creeping in on them, not a soul would have seen daybreak. That was what it was, thought I, to have the captain wounded. And again I blamed myself sharply for leaving them in that danger with so few to mount guard. By this time I got to the door and stood up. All was dark within so that I could distinguish nothing by the eye. As for sounds, there was the steady drone of the snorers, and a small occasional noise, a flickering or a pecking, that I could in no way account for. With my arms before me, I walked steadily in. I should lie down in my own place, I thought, with a silent chuckle, and enjoy their faces when they found me in the morning. My foot struck something yielding. It was the sleeper's leg, and he turned and groaned, but without awakening. And then, all of a sudden, a shrill voice broke forth out of the darkness. "Pieces of eight! Pieces of eight! Pieces of eight! Pieces of eight! Pieces of eight!" and so forth, without pause or change, like the clacking of a tiny mill. Silver's green parrot, Captain Flint, it was she whom I had heard pecking at a piece of bark. It was she, keeping better watch than any human being, who thus announced my arrival with her wearisome refrain. I had no time left me to recover. At the sharp, clipping tone of the parrot, the sleepers awoke and sprang up, and with a mighty oath, the roar of Silver cried, "Who goes?" I turned to run, struck violently against one person, recoiled and ran full into the arms of a second, who for his part closed upon and held me tight. "Bring a torch, Dick," said Silver. When my capture was thus assured, and one of the men left the log house and presently returned with a lighted brand.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Greave for reading it. That was Chapter 27, Part 2. Chapter 28 next week.
Tim Burrows has joined us with his guitar, and he's got a new song to play for us. It's called From Portishead to Paris, Texas. And here it is. Many thanks, Tim. And I hear you have a gig to plug.
Yes, I've been kindly asked to run an open mic at the Pierian Centre. They're having a closing bash on Tuesday the 6th from 5:30 till 7. So if anyone wants to drop in to do a poem or sing a song, I should get there early, but it's going to be a good do.
So that's the Pierian Centre in Portland Square?
Yeah.
Brilliant. Square, yeah. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks.
Time for the What's On Guide as ever. Sadly, Jeff has been called away. He's been invited to judge a Women's Institute speed knitting contest in Chew Magna tonight. But I've done a little bit of research myself for what's going on in the Bristol and Swindon area. John Lennon's birthday is coming up, so we've got John Lennon Remembrance Day. We've got two, in fact. We've got one on the Thursday, the 8th of December. That's going on at the Thunderbolt, which is off the Wells Road, south of the river. Remembering John Lennon presents a five-piece band, Sgt. Pepper's Only Dartboard Band, who are renowned for their storming live shows. You can check them out at sgtpeppertribute.co.uk. That's £5 on the door or £4 in advance from the Bristol Ticket Shop on Union Street. And that's on Thursday the 8th. If you wish to go to a second, should you be possessed by the thought that that would be a fantastic thing to do, on Friday the 9th you can go to the Vic in Swindon, which is on Victoria Street. And they're having a John Lennon tribute night as well. They haven't quite sorted out all the bands, so if you know a John Lennon tune and can strum a guitar, then get in touch with them. Go and visit Golden Ha support group at goldenha.org.uk. On Wednesday the 7th, rolling back a little bit, at the Fleece in St Thomas Street here in Bristol, Napalm Death are performing, an absolutely storming band who've been around since the early 80s, and a variety of support including Witch Cult, Human Cull, and a local band Merciless Precision, who are always extremely enthusiastic. On Friday the 9th of December, in a jazz vein, we've got Andy Shepherd and the Pushy Doctors. This awesome trio is made up of Tony Oral, Andy Shepherd and Dan Moore. So anybody who knows anything about jazz will know that is a very, very good gifted lineup. And they've been sitting at Bristol this year with their Hot Fried Punk Jazz. Andy Shepherd is one of Bristol's foremost tenor and soprano saxophonists. £6 on the door, £5 advance from the Bristol Ticket Shop. Once again, that's going on at the Thunderbolt, south of the river. At the same venue on Saturday the 10th of December, the next day, the Imperials, as in Imperials, not Imperials. They're a UK ska band, a really long-running band, and they do very entertaining, professional, and extremely lively shows. Again, £5 on the door, £4 in advance from the Bristol Ticket Shop. At the Colston Hall, lastly, Bristol Music Industry Network meeting is going on. This is a free thing. It's an open forum for music industry professionals. So if you reckon you can blag calling yourself as such, you might be able to get a free ticket and go along, do a bit of networking, discuss issues that we all face, and work with other people to develop strong, thriving music scene in and around Bristol. So if you're interested in organising gigs or whatever, see if you can go along. Oh, and there's also a Kate Bush tribute band by Never Forever, and that's going on Sunday, 4th of December, at the Vic in Swindon once again, 88 Victoria Road. So a good variety of bands for you in the coming week. Okay, it's come to the end of the show. You might be interested to know where our theme tune is from. Eagle-eared listeners will know, of course, it is the theme tune to the TV programme Shoestring, which was from a very long time ago in the late 70s. It's based in Bristol and filmed around here. It's finally been given a release, a legal release at least, courtesy of BBC DVD. Series 1 has been released, so our theme tune, which the theme tune is Shoestring, you can actually watch as part of the original series. Finally, well, the What's On Guide was read by myself, John Peters Coleman. We thank you very much to David Owen for coming in and being interviewed. The features were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling, and thank you very much to Malcolm Gree for reading the second half of chapter 27 of Treasure Island. Thank you also to Tim Burrows for playing such a lovely tune. Thank you very much to Jeff Sparks for his general inputs as ever. The presenter was myself, John Peters Coleman,
and myself, Michaela Dennis. The engineer was Michael Noyes, and the producer was Anthea Page. See you next week.
Revolution. Revolution.